And, we might be late for dinner. Those last few words rushed out of his mouth. Okay, Tommy, what's up? There was a tone of excitement in his voice that she recognized from all the years she'd known him. We're going to Tiffany's in a few minutes. Thank goodness they're open till 7 tonight. We're looking for rings. Tommy, sweetie, does that mean what I think it means? Yes, we're getting engaged. Can you believe it? I'm in love. We're in love. He was breaking down as he spoke, overcome by emotion, and Jessica felt herself tearing up. Just when you thought rot had overtaken the world in which you live, something wonderful happened. True love was a rare event, so why not celebrate like mad when it happened? She was smiling ear to ear, a cloud lifted from her. Love lifts you up, she thought, remembering those words first spoken to her by Bernadette, years ago and repeated many times since. I'm overjoyed. Can we meet you there and see what you two picked out? I mean, it's okay, right? You're ready to make this public, yes? Oh, hell yes. If I could get on Eye on the Desert, I'd let Patrick Evans break the news to all my friends. Don't do that. You might get a fan following. I'm not sure you two want that, do you? I wish we could skip all the dark stuff tonight altogether and just celebrate. But I need to share what I found out today and get input from the rest of you. Maybe you're right about not needing to make a media splash. Don't worry about dark stuff, though. I'm on cloud 9, or 10, or whatever. Nothing will get to me tonight. You deserve all the happiness in the world. Head on over to Tiffany's, and I'll call everyone and spread the word. We won't get there until right before closing time to give you a little privacy. Then we'll all walk on over to Spago for dinner at 8, okay? Sounds great. I'll go tell Jerry. He's making himself look gorgeous. Like he needs to work at that. I am so lucky that he loves me. There was wonder in that breathless statement. Yes, you are lucky. You know what?
What?
I love you too, she said. Aw, that's another reason I'm so lucky. What would I have done if you hadn't loved me all these years? After Kelly, without you, I would have been lost, like she was. Tommy choked up. Don't think about that tonight. We're doing what we can to rid the world of sickos who prey on lost young women. Love is still the best antidote to all that sorrow, and you've found that. Let's get this party started, okay?
Okay. My dream date is all ready to go. See you in a little while.
The wheels in her head were turning. First, she called everybody and asked that they meet in the lobby so they could walk over to Tiffany's together. She didn't tell them why, just that they should get ready for a big surprise. Next, she called the store to make sure the rings got charged to her and not to the lovebirds, a small price to pay for the hope those few words from Tommy had brought her. She also made sure the shop would accommodate them if things weren't all wrapped up by 7 on the dot. That was not a problem. Last, she ordered little gifts for each of them to mark the occasion, pendant necklaces with hearts for the women and key rings for the men. Each would be engraved with Bernadette's words, "Love lifts you up." When they arrived at Tiffany's and figured out what was going on, everyone's mood was ebullient. Tommy and Jerry had narrowed down their choices to 3. With a little feedback from the cat pack, they made their final selections. 2 sleek bands of white gold, each with a single diamond. By the time they all walked out of the shop, it was 7:30, and apart from Brian's concern about getting to Spago by 8, no one worried about a thing. It was all so wonderful. I don't get how life can change in a split second, do you? Jessica snapped her fingers. I know it happens, Jessica, Bernadette replied. She did, too, having lost the love of her life at a young age. Bernadette knew well that life could be one way one day and different the next. Remembering that moment while sitting in the police car, Jessica shut her eyes as though she could shield herself from the memory of what had happened next. They'd all stood outside Tiffany's, thanking the security guard as he let them out of doors he'd locked at closing time. Jessica hadn't noticed, but Peter had gone into security mode when they hit the street. He called out, "Gun, back inside the store, now!" The guard didn't hesitate and held the door open for them.
As Peter called out, he jumped in front of Jessica, pulling her a step closer to the doorway. They all scrambled to follow his orders. He was the last to retreat, still scanning the street as he backed through the doorway.
"It all happened so fast," Jessica sighed, recalling an all-too-familiar sound. Gunfire.
As Peter took that last step through the doorway, he was hit. The impact, along with his own efforts to get inside, propelled him backward, and he fell hard onto the floor. As the door to Tiffany's shut, a second bullet struck and pinged off the overhang that sheltered the store entryway. The security guard had pulled a gun from his holster, and someone triggered a silent alarm. The police must have responded instantly, perhaps fearing a robbery was underway at the legendary jewelry store, as sirens could be heard in a matter of seconds. The guard also called in medical help for Peter. Not sure where the bullet hit, Jessica ventured to have a look, her heart pounding as she bent over Peter. He was lying motionless on the floor, his eyes closed. There had been an awful crack when the huge man struck the floor.
"No blood," Jessica remembered saying, right before letting out a yelp.
Several other Cat Pack members echoed with yelps of their own. Almost in unison, they jumped back, startled because Peter's eyes had popped open, and he sat up, rubbing the back of his head.
"Whoa, it's like seeing a dead body sit up in a morgue, like in a zombie or a vampire movie," Brian said.
"Awesome. Are you okay, bro?"
"I'm not dead, and I'm not your bro. Yes, I'm okay. Thanks for asking."
"But you got shot, dude,"
Brian persisted.
"Yeah, that's too bad. Messed up the leather. I'll have to get it fixed,"
Peter said, looking at the front of his jacket.
"Kevlar worked, though. It stopped the bullet, but it knocked me on my behind."
Peter, that wasn't your behind that made that cracking sound when you hit the floor,"
Brian said.
"You'd better stay put until the EMTs get here and check you out,"
the security guard admonished Peter, placing his weapon back in its holster. In almost the same instant, there was a pounding on the door. The first responders had arrived. Once it had become clear there was no robbery in progress, the store had gone back to closing for the night. Police fanned out and searched the area for a shooter. EMTs moved Peter to the back of a rescue vehicle while they checked him out. He would have a nasty bump on his head, but other than that, he was unharmed. They'd all joined Peter as a police officer took his statement.
"My guess is the shooter had you in mind as the target, Jessica,"
Peter had said.
"You think it's the sniper that's been on the loose?"
Bernadette asked.
"That was no sniper," Peter told them and the police. "A sniper wouldn't have waved a handgun around like that for me to see, and a sniper would have aimed higher."
As Peter told the police, he'd spotted a figure standing across the street, wearing a baseball cap and in dark, baggy clothes, sweats, short, maybe 5'5", maybe too small to be a man.
"Are you saying it was a woman?"
a police officer asked. "Was she an enormously pregnant platinum blonde?" Jessica had asked. The only woman Jessica could imagine gunning for her was Cassie Harper. It wouldn't be the first time their paths had crossed on Rodeo Drive.
"I don't think the clothes were baggy enough to hide an enormously pregnant woman. Cassie's taller than that, too. I could be wrong about it being a woman, but that bullet is from a low-caliber handgun. A girly gun. Whoever did this was out of here quick, too. It doesn't sound like your ex-husband's wife is in any shape to make a getaway like that shooter was able to do."
The officer was staring, like he was trying to figure out what to write down.
"Hang on," he said. "I'll call in the description you just gave me."
He stepped away for a moment while they continued to stand, mulling over events.
"Even if it wasn't her, you might be in Cassie's crosshairs now, though. When this gets out, she'll hate you even more for upstaging her again. And on holy ground, Rodeo Drive," Laura had said, trying to lighten the mood.
"Great. That's just what I need. Two angry women trying to shoot me," she said.
"What if it's one of those fans of yours turned stalker?" Tommy asked.
He was moving into prankster mode. They all headed in that direction, as stress from the strange turn of events took hold.
"Let's not forget that the sniper is still out there," Kim added.
They all looked at Kim,
trying to figure out why she brought that up. So maybe three shooters after you. I'm just saying, she added, giving her shoulders a little shrug.
Tommy, I'm sorry about this. I feel horrible about ruining your wonderful evening, missing our reservation at Spago, and, oh yeah, putting your life at risk from a stray bullet.
Please don't say you're sorry. First, this is not your fault. Second, we can do Spago another time. And third, this has to be one of the most memorable engagement events on record. Am I right, Jerry?
You'll get no argument from me about any of that. This is one for the grandkids.
Jerry smiled as he reached out and put his arm around Tommy's shoulders. Tommy turned to mush right before Jessica's eyes.
Let's not forget we haven't had dinner yet. There's still time to celebrate, right?
That was Brian making sure they all kept their priorities, in other words, his stomach, right.
Officer, how long is it going to take to wrap this up? We're hungry.
The police officer, who had rejoined them, just stared at Brian for a few seconds, shook his head, and went back to making notes.
Once I'm done with Mr. March here, I'll let each of you tell your story for the record. Then you can go. It doesn't sound like we have much to go on. Maybe we'll pick up somebody in the area thanks to that description, but I wouldn't count on it. Keep an eye on your friend here, who just happens to be wearing Kevlar, just in case that bump on the head turns out to be worse than it seems now.
He eyed the motley little band with wariness.
I'm not sure what you all are mixed up in, but I think it's time to back off.
That's a record, Jessica thought. A police warning to back off, issued like a citation in under 15 minutes.
Thanks, officer. We'll take that under advisement, she had responded.
Sounds like lawyer lingo. Ms. Huntington, is it?
He asked, checking the list of names he'd made. Before she could respond, he went on.
Huntington. Jessica Huntington. Why does that name sound so familiar?
Then it hit him.
You're the Angel Heiress, right?
He said, shaking his head again.
Wait till the guys hear about this. You're next.
Jessica had little to tell the officer about what had happened that night. When he asked who might have it in for her, about her buddy in Kevlar, and their comments that it might not be the sniper who targeted her that night, she was too tired to explain it all. She suggested, if he wanted to know more, that he speak to officers in another of the jurisdictions involved, referring him to George Hernandez and both Fontanas. Later, when he dropped them at the hotel, he spoke to Jessica.
We may have more questions for you all after we check with the Cathedral City PD and Palm Springs PD and the Riverside County Sheriff's Department.
He shook his head again, took the business card Jessica handed him, and helped her out of the back of the police car as she struggled with one arm in a sling.
You are one lucky lady, Jessica Huntington, was the last thing he said to her.
The next person who tells me how lucky I am is in for a dose of bad luck. Of my making, she thought, as she joined her friends in the lobby. That's all she wanted to hear, another cop telling her how lucky she was. Enough already. It's almost as annoying as being told to back off, she thought, as she thanked the man for the ride. The police officer had insisted they be driven to the hotel, even though they were only a couple of blocks away. As he had pulled up at the hotel entrance, Jessica checked the time, using her smartphone. It was after 9 o'clock. She'd received phone calls during the melee and had voicemail messages, several of them from her mother.
Oh, no, she said, after listening to the voicemails.
Her mom had become more anxious with each call. Jessica stopped in the lobby to call her. She decided to keep the latest bad news to herself.
Sorry, Mom. I had the phone off for a while. It's been a wild night. Tommy and Jerry are getting married.
Her friends were standing a short distance away, waiting for her. When she finished her call, they all moved toward the hotel restaurant that was still open for dinner.
Okay, well, I planned to tell you this over dinner, but Mom has helped us figure out who Libby's Red Devil might be. His name is Eric Conroy. He has, or had, a woman friend we need to talk to about him. She might just be the key to figuring out this whole scheme. I had a plan I wanted to run by you about who to talk to next,
but Sally Winchester has just gone to the top of my to-be-interviewed list. Laura stopped in her tracks.
Well, that will be hard to do. She's dead.
They all stood there for a moment before Brian went into fearless leader mode.
We need food. Follow me,
he said, making a beeline for the restaurant. 28. More women. Saturday evening, before the debacle on Rodeo Drive, Jessica had decided that she would visit Pinnacle. She planned to track down Carla Ferguson in person Monday morning. She'd make an appointment with the woman if she could get one. If that didn't work, she intended to lie in wait and confront her if she spotted her, at lunch or at the end of the day. Basically, Jessica's strategy was to stalk the Ferguson woman until she agreed to speak to her. Cornering her while the pressure was on with the impending IPO felt like the best chance to find out what was going on. As exhausted as they were, there was a palpable sense of anticipation in their little group as they sat down for their belated dinner. Seated in the posh restaurant at the Beverly Wilshire Hotel, late on a Sunday night, there wasn't much of a crowd. Thankfully, for Brian's sake, they ordered food right away, getting bread and crudité into Brian's hands before he passed out. The staff served champagne right away, too, and they toasted Tommy and Jerry's engagement, as well as their good fortune that no one was seriously hurt.
To Kevlar, Peter offered, after they'd said cheers to Tommy and Jerry.
Jessica, throwing caution to the wind, raised her own sparkling crystal glass of bubbly. Then Peter turned to Laura and Jessica.
Okay, what gives, you two?
First things first, I guess. As I said before we sat down, thanks to Mom, I now know who the guy is in that photo taken outside Carr's office. I'm also sure he's Libby's Red Devil and Carr's co-conspirator. With that statement, she passed around her phone. Front and center was a full-color picture of Eric Conroy pulled off the web, the goatee and shock of red hair on display. Murmurs and gasps circled the table as they passed the photo around. Jessica explained how her mother had found the black-and-white photo of Eric Conroy on her phone and immediately recognized him. Conroy has deep pockets, about to get even deeper if all goes as planned. There were more gasps as she filled them in on the man's connection to Pinnacle, the IPO set to launch, and the amount of money at stake. All eyes were on her, too, when she revealed that Ned Donnelly was on Pinnacle's board.
That's a ton of money, Tommy said. He must be under pressure with that timeline hanging over him, Peter added.
Yeah, all he needs is some yahoo like Libby or Shannon stirring up trouble with the deal of a lifetime in progress. Guys like him don't want to take any chances with mouthy young women. Kim looked angry as she said those words. A moment of silence passed as Kelly's presence seemed to hover over them. Appetizers and another bottle of champagne broke the spell. I've already shared this information with Detective Hernandez, who will have another conversation with Ned Donnelly. Here's the best I can do for now to connect the dots. I have a hunch that Shannon Donnelly was giving her parents the same grief Libby's been doling out, allegations made about her father or another family member. Ned Donnelly looks grim months before his daughter disappears. He's one of several unhappy campers in the background at Pinnacle board meetings where Conroy is basking in the limelight. Jessica nibbled on a breadstick to ease a mild sensation of nausea brought on by stress, hunger, and low lives. Maybe Shannon was after money, or Carr's love, but extortion can pressure people into doing many things, like getting you to vote a certain way at board meetings, or it might be enough to get you to resign if you're unwilling to cast your vote his way. What helped me get this far along in my thinking is another bit of information from Mom. She called me while we were in Tiffany's and again when we were tied up afterward. When I called her back a few minutes ago, she said she remembered where she met Conroy. He was involved with Dorothy Winchester's daughter, Sally. Surprise, surprise, Dottie Winchester served on Pinnacle's board of directors for years, resigning not long before that IPO vote took place. Fortunate for Conroy, since Mom says Dottie didn't approve of the man, not in a leadership role at Pinnacle and not as a prospective son-in-law. Mom suggested I speak to Sally Winchester if I had concerns about him. That won't happen, though. Will it, Laura? She glanced at Laura, uneasy to hear what she had to say about another dead daughter.
No, it won't, Laura replied. When you were in the hospital, you mentioned, in passing, that there might be more women tied to Carr. That got me thinking. Carr spent a lot of time out in the desert with troubled young women in tow. Given his medical credentials, I wondered if he'd ever admitted patients to the hospital. So I checked with a friend in medical records and asked her to check. Then, Kim, when you said that with men like Carr there are always more women, I decided to call my friend and see if she had found anything. What she discovered is that Libby Vanderwert was admitted to the hospital weeks ago when she accidentally took more medication than prescribed. Carr was the admitting physician. They pumped Libby's stomach, kept her around until the next morning, and then released her into his care.
Okay, that's news. Not the least bit un-Libby-like, however, Jessica said.
True, but before that, there was another similar situation, an accidental overdose. Unlike Libby, at the time of her admission, Sally Winchester was unconscious. She never recovered consciousness and died the next morning. It was Carr who called an ambulance and asked to have her admitted. He claimed Sally had called him, complaining she didn't feel well, and he was concerned that she might have taken too many pills or something like that. My friend remembers the incident well because there was an inquest to determine if the death was an accidental overdose or a suicide. Sally Winchester had a lot of drugs in her system at the time of death. Besides the ones prescribed for her by Carr, she took medication for congestive heart failure. Her weakened heart, the overdose, drug interactions, or all of the above contributed to a radical drop in blood pressure. That triggered a massive stroke that killed her. So, officially, stroke was ruled the cause of death, and an accidental overdose the manner of death. Sally was young, just 33 years old, another reason my friend remembers the incident so well. They all lapsed into silence once again. Tired and hungry, they spent the next few minutes finishing their appetizers. They must have looked glum, because several of their servers stopped to ask if everything was okay, and could they get them anything else before their main courses arrived. Brian asked for more bread, but the others only did what they could to be polite and smile in response to the server's inquiries. Once their meals arrived, a few minutes later, Jessica could finally speak again.
"Yet another sad story involving Carr. It makes me sick," she sputtered.
"Maybe her daughter's death is what led to Dottie Winchester's resignation. That sleaze Conroy is mixed up in this. I just know it. I wonder how close that vote was that won Conroy the deal of a lifetime. Sally Winchester might have had plenty to tell us about her ambitious suitor. Too bad she's dead."
"Her mother's not dead," Bernadette said. "She might have plenty to say about Conroy, too. She worked with him and must know what went on between him and her daughter. Get Alexis to call her, and let's go see her," Bernadette said.
"I'll drive."
"Oh, no, you won't," Peter said, "not with someone taking pot shots at Jessica. If Dorothy Winchester agrees to speak to you tomorrow, Brian and I will drive. I mean drive, as in you and Jessica sit in the back seat," Peter said, trying not to look at the enormous steak Brian was devouring.
"Speaking of things that make you sick, what is that? About 3 pounds of raw beef, Brian?"
2 pounds. Rare, man. Just the way I like it."
"Shotgun," Brian said, to claim his favorite seat, before plunging his knife back into the porterhouse steak meant for two.
"Why do you think I said they would be sitting in the back?" Peter asked, averting his eyes again from the massacre underway on Brian's plate.
"Oh, yeah, okay."
He shrugged.
"It feels like it must be about 2 a.m., but it's not even 10 yet. I'll step out and call Mom. If she feels okay about calling Dottie Winchester, I'll ask her to see if she's willing to talk to us."
When Jessica returned, her food looked delicious. Her appetite was back.
"All set, guys. Mom got Dottie on the phone and called me back right away. Dottie is more than willing to have a conversation. She's been trying to convince people for years that Conroy is no good. We're all set for tomorrow after lunch, at her place near Pasadena."
"Wow, that's amazing. Go Alexis," Tommy said.
"Maybe she'll give you something that will get the police to investigate Conroy," Jerry added.
Maybe. But I have another angle to pursue, too. I've also discovered who the woman is in that photo with Carr and Conroy, taken outside Carr's office.
You've been busy, Kim commented.
What can I say? I'm motivated. And if we figure this out, we won't have to be dodging bullets from shooters, amateurs or professionals. Here's the scoop on the blonde in that photo with a penchant for Prada, she said, and then filled them in on her plan to confront Carla Ferguson at Pinnacle on Monday morning.
Could you do that, Peter?
You know, stick around and play bodyguard on Monday?
Sure I can. It's good to be the boss, he replied,
in a better mood now that his roasted vegetables, quinoa, and other well-prepared vegan choices from the menu had put him in a culinary-induced happy place.
I'm the boss of my pool business, too, so I'll have a talk with myself and figure out how to make it work,
Brian said, smiling. They were all giving him the, are you serious, kind of scrutiny. Brian flicked his head so the shock of blonde hair, which had fallen into his eyes, moved back into place. The smile he wore was a reminder that he was a good-looking guy. Jessica caught Kim lingering on that smile before she shook her head and went back to eating.
Just in case you were wondering, that was a joke. I have to call a friend of mine to sub for me, but I don't have to talk to myself before I do that.
What can the rest of us do while you're meeting with the little old lady in Pasadena and trying to corner the woman in Prada? Tommy asked. Jerry and I have already fixed our schedules, so Monday's clear.
Well, since you asked, I can't believe Conroy hasn't been in trouble before, so digging into his background would be great if you two will do that while we're in Pasadena. Kim, I also want anything you can find in the way of financial data about Pinnacle, like the stuff you uncovered about your old boss's enterprising ways. They all nodded in agreement.
Laura, do you have any connections with staff in medical facilities here in L.A., like the hospital at UCLA or Cedars-Sinai? It might be worth checking to see if Carr's been entangled in similar incidents involving distraught young women admitted to ERs for accidental overdoses in Beverly Hills.
I can ask, but it might take me a while to figure it out.
No problem. We could all use some spa time in the morning, don't you think? So, how does it sound if we spend the morning getting the stress massaged out of us, go to the terrific brunch they serve here, and leave the snooping to the afternoon? That brought on another round of toasts as they finished their dinners.
What's for dessert?
Brian asked, minutes later, as servers swept in to remove their plates. Dessert menus appeared.
Wow, there are surprises on this. Even vegan goodies, Peter proclaimed, looking almost as eager as Brian was.
Speaking of surprises, Tommy said as he handed Jessica his phone. Angel Eris targeted by unknown assailant on Rodeo Drive, the banner headline read, accompanied by a photo of police and rescue vehicles parked outside Tiffany's.
Great. I'm in the news again.
Just what I need, Jessica moaned, handing the phone back to Tommy. Maybe we should hire paparazzi to find out what this Conroy character is up to. They're really on the ball.
Sorry. That's not what I wanted you to see. It's this.
Tommy handed the phone back to her, and she read the headline out loud. Hollywood's blonde bombshell goes into labor at upscale bistro. Sparks fly.
Yes. Thank you, Cassie. Another diversion from the limelight, courtesy of Jim's beloved.
Woo-hoo-hoo, Jessica announced, picking up her champagne glass.
I have to say, the woman's timing is impeccable, Laura added. No way was she going to let the Angel Heiress monopolize the headlines.
And talk about an ironclad alibi, Jerry added. She couldn't have been your shooter tonight, that's for sure.
To life. Even with Cassie the worm-hearted as your mother, Jessica said.
To perfect timing, and all the paparazzi and fans she could ever want, Laura added.
Dinner, and maybe the champagne, had done wonders for their spirits. Jessica felt back in control, hoping it was more than just the buzz from wielding that black Amex card as she'd been doing the past couple of days. She flashed for a moment on that earlier conversation with Bernadette and her mother. Here she was again, masterminding an extravaganza in the middle of an investigation into muck and mire, all courtesy of well-dressed men cast as winners and milling about in hoity-toity circles, it couldn't keep that sinking feeling away completely, but oohs and ahs over desserts kept the volume low on the questions that dogged her. 29. Kierkegaard snaps.
What can I say? It wasn't me, Kirk groused. Don't get annoyed with me, Kierkegaard. I'm the guy who sends you money, remember? When and if you do a job the right way, that is,
Conroy said, chomping on a cigar. He lit it to celebrate the fact that this was the last Sunday he would ever spend as a chump working for Pinnacle. By next Sunday, L.A. would be a fading memory. Not a pleasant one at this point.
Don't call me that. Nobody calls me that, Kirk snapped.
Set off an existential crisis, did I?
Eric laughed, intending to be nasty.
Let me remind you, I'm also the guy who can make or break you. Not just your reputation, but your legs.
Or your neck, he thought. The man on the other end of the phone took a deep breath, but he sounded no less annoyed when he spoke again.
You said keep an eye on her, so that's what I've been doing. If I had shot at her, do you think I would have missed?
If you didn't do it, who did?
I don't know. You said keep tabs on her, not babysit.
She has a bodyguard of her own to do that. I hear he took a bullet for her. He was wearing a Kevlar undershirt or something, so he's okay.
Just say the word and I'll take a shot. Is that what you want?
No, no. Don't do that. What I want is to slide into Friday nice and quiet. I guess whoever took that shot at her did us a favor, eh? That ought to get Jessica Huntington to cool it. Good grief, it's only been a week since Libby Vanderwerp shoved her off a mountaintop. What is she doing here in L.A. anyway?
From what I can tell, partying with her friends. They all checked in for the weekend at the Beverly Wilshire and hit Tiffany's tonight. Some reporter said the visit to Tiffany's had something to do with an engagement ring. Huntington and her friend, a family housekeeper or something like that, visited a clinic in Malibu this afternoon before she met up with friends at Tiffany's, Kirk replied.
A Malibu clinic? As in rehab? Is she looking to check herself in?
Eric asked.
Yes, as in rehab. Transformations, a high-end place that caters to celebrities. I'm sure you must have heard of it. I can find out why she made that visit if you want me to. Does it matter? No, I guess not. I still want you to keep an eye on her.
Will do, he said before he terminated the call. Eric was taken aback.
You are pushing it, my friend,
he muttered, staring at the blank cell phone screen.
No more business for me, that's for sure.
He relit his cigar and took a few puffs. It didn't matter. Soon he wouldn't need to work with Kierkegaard Kunzel or anyone like him ever again. That thought lifted his mood. Friday loomed with the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. What if he had to put up with a few more dust-ups? Who cares?
Who names a kid Kierkegaard anyway? No wonder he ended up as a cranky gun for hire,
he snorted in between puffs on his cigar. Still, it nagged at him that the Huntington woman was in L.A., had dodged a bullet from an unknown assailant, and had garnered more news coverage. Who else had the busybody in their scope? Was she involved in some drug-related case? Could be she'd picked up the wrong client at that cushy rehab resort, or stepped over the line trying to be helpful.
It would be just like her. She comes from a long line of snooty do-gooders. Not my problem. Hope she gets what she deserves.
He took a big swig of the cognac he'd poured for himself. The previous night, both the current and former Mrs. Harpers had been on screen, side by side, on every site that catered to the entertainment industry. They'd rebroadcast the story this morning of the Tiffany's incident, but it was already yesterday's news. Cassie Carlisle Harper, or whatever her name was, sure was a looker. Tall, blonde, and built. At least until she blew up like a blimp. She'd stolen the headlines. He had to hand it to the Hollywood star. The woman knew how to draw attention. Not all of it good, but then,
there's no such thing as bad publicity, is there?
Eric asked, speaking aloud in his empty office.
No one could afford the kind of coverage she's getting from this. Well, maybe I could, once those Pinnacle shares are sold on Friday, he chortled. He poured himself more cognac and sat down to finish his cigar, watching the footage being rebroadcast. The latest scene featuring the tantrum-prone star relegated the trouble at Tiffany's to page 2. Just like that. A proclamation had gone out through all La La Land. Cassie Carlyle had gone into labor, diva-style, at a trendy restaurant where she and the buffoon she wed in the past year had gone for a late dinner. With Huntington and Carlyle as notches on his belt, that guy must have done something. I don't see it, Eric muttered as he stared at a reporter interviewing restaurant staff. He didn't need to hear it all again, even though parts of it were funny. Less than an hour after that scene on Rodeo Drive, featuring the previous Mrs. Harper, the new Mrs. Harper countered with that photo op of her own. The pregnant woman had been ornery since her arrival at the restaurant. She ordered items and then sent them back when they didn't meet with her approval. Known to have a temper and already facing assault charges, she hadn't struck anyone or raised her voice. But when her water broke, she panicked. Panicky wasn't much better or very different from angry, apparently. There weren't any cameras in the house at that point, but diners whipped out smartphones and jumpy images made their way to television screens everywhere. He chuckled as those clips reappeared. Cassie Carlyle was holding her belly, howling like a werewolf or something. The suit she'd married, James Harper, tried to calm her down when the cheeky broad hauled off and slapped him, right in the face. Eric guffawed out loud. He wouldn't have laughed if a woman had hit him, or shrieked at him like that. No matter how blonde and well-endowed, he would have put her in her place. You loser. She's cussing like a sailor and threatening to kill you. All you do is stand there and take it. Oh, no. Look out. Look out, he said, as a clip featuring the wailing woman taking swings at restaurant staff trying to help her. Food was flying, and patrons were scrambling. Help her get the hell out of that restaurant. You could sure use my services to put the right spin on this disaster, he said, shaking his head. Sorry to say, I won't be around to help you. Salut. He raised his glass with that salute and hit the off button on the TV just as the network reran footage of the EMTs joining the circus. The press was on their heels. Hear this, he announced, making a vow as he refilled his glass. My future won't be dictated by a troublesome female. You will all stay out of my way if you know what's good for you. Eric downed the second drink he'd poured. He didn't much care what Libby Vanderwerp had on Carr or what Jessica Huntington was up to. Let them try to throw a monkey wrench into his plans. He was no James Harper, gaping, slack-jawed at a woman who didn't know when enough was enough. He knew exactly what to do with uppity women, especially when they became too much trouble. 30. Wicked Women. At one point she was screaming, Jim, you blankety-blank-blank, touch me and I'll kill you. There were brief glimpses of her face, but she could do it. Kill him, I mean. Jim is toast, Tommy announced to the group, seated around a table at Sunday brunch. Oh, no, man. Not another dead husband, Brian said, hanging on every word Tommy spoke. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy, Laura commented with a smirk on her face. Everyone at the table gawked at Laura, astounded that those words came from her. It had been less than 6 months since her husband was murdered. Hey, Jim's a jerk. So is she. In this case, it might be a mercy killing, not even a murder. Laura shrugged as she took a delicate bite from a strip of bacon. She has assault charges pending, so Jim could be in more trouble than he knows. Not my problem. What was she doing out on the town in her condition anyway? Jessica asked. Where I come from, you work until the last minute and have that baby wherever you are. You city girls got it good. For my mother and her friends, it wasn't a fancy restaurant like that. A baby will get here whether you're cleaning the fish, hanging laundry, or feeding the chickens. Point taken. But even on a good day, this woman is a beast. They ought to have her in seclusion or restrained and under an armed guard in her condition.
At least they got her out of there, so the whole world didn't have to witness that succubus give birth.
It's like the Blair Witch Project, Beverly Hills style, with all those dark, jumpy video clips.
Spooky, Brian said, doing his man-in-the-know head bobble. Jessica hadn't seen the movie, but those scary scenes with eerily lighted selfies and a lot of heavy breathing came to mind from the movie promos, so maybe.
I'm not sure I get that succubus part, though.
A puzzled puppy dog expression had replaced that man-in-the-know look on Brian's face.
I'll explain it to you later, Peter offered.
Thanks, dude. Brian dove back into the stack of challah French toast on his plate, satisfied with that promise from Peter. The brunch, like their spa visit and everything else at the Beverly Wilshire, was first rate, and Brian was making the most of it.
The witch part of Blair Witch Project sounds about right, Kim acknowledged.
Yeah, she put curses on everyone in that restaurant before the EMTs arrived a few minutes after the chaos began. That was on top of curses directed at Jim, just in case you didn't recognize him in the blurry smartphone video clips being tweeted out. Her vicious voiceovers make sure you know who her baby daddy is.
James Harper, you jerk! You did this! I'll make you pay!
Followed by a string of expletives and growling.
Grr!
Tommy said, mimicking her nasty tone of voice and the growl that followed.
Whoa, that is wicked,
Brian said with great conviction.
If he doesn't start divorce proceedings before the end of the year, I'll be astonished, Jerry added.
Some people will put up with lots of abuse. Besides, Jim will look like an even bigger jerk than he does now if he files for divorce from his wife who just gave birth. He's screwed until next year at least.
You're right, Kim. When she leaves the hospital carrying her little bundle of joy, all the world will coo at her. Jim's in for months, maybe years of this. If he files for divorce, can you imagine that?
The custody battle will be epic, Laura said.
He'll wish he was a dead husband. Everyone stared at her again as she stabbed a chunk of melon on her plate.
What?
What did I say now? You don't think Jim will kill her, do you?
I doubt anybody will kill anybody.
Some divorce lawyers stand to make a fortune if they go in that direction, Jessica said, sighing. And yes, there's likely to be one hell of a custody battle. With Cassie and Jim as parents, it could be the first one ever that's about who's forced to end up with the baby. I can't imagine either one of them wanting to be a parent.
Sì, pobre bambino,
Bernadette said with sadness. Poor baby is right. If the child is anything like her mother, the rest of us will be sorry, too. Just look at how much grief one Cassie, Libby, or Marguerite can cause, Laura said in a woeful way. Despite her seeming glibness about murder, the memory of the wretched Marguerite still caused pain.
You don't believe in the whole tabla rasa thing? Peter asked.
Yo, Peter, are you speaking Spanish now, too?
Tabla rasa?
Brian enunciated each syllable.
What's that?
Latin, Brian, and tabla rasa means when you're born, your mind is a blank slate, ready for whatever life writes on it,
Peter added.
Blank slate? Oh, okay,
Brian repeated, with a stare to match.
Some slates are blanker than others, Kim muttered under her breath.
Peter just shook his head.
What? Okay,
Brian said, trying to figure out what the murmurs meant.
You'll tell me later, right?
Sure, Peter said, and went to work eating the food on his plate. I don't know about Cassie or Marguerite, but Libby's situation sure makes a case for genes, though. She lived about as close to a charmed life as you can get. Her parents loved her, have given her everything, and they've gone to professionals for help since she was a kid. She's like a throwback to her grandmother, according to Nora.
And yes, poor baby is right, Bernadette. That child will have nature and nurture working against it. I can't imagine anyone spending a childhood with Cassie Carlisle Harper and ending up whole.
Was it a boy or a girl?
Girl, Tommy said. If it's about genes, she's doomed.
Well, I wouldn't go that far.
Heck, I still have hope for Libby if she recovers from that last round of seizures. She's capable of feeling something close to remorse, based on what I heard up there on Mount San Jacinto before Carr showed up. Carr's a whole different animal. Was a whole different animal. His associate, Eric Conroy, must be too. That was a cold, calculating decision to pay someone to go into the ICU and kill Libby. A guy like that has to be stopped. Jessica was emphatic as she spoke. What would it take to stop Eric Conroy, she wondered.
It is odd how these people find each other, isn't it? Not just Cassie and Jim, but Libby and Shannon and Dr. Dick. And now Conroy seems to have had his hooks into another doomed woman, Jerry commented.
Two of them, possibly. It's not just Sally Winchester who seems to have become involved with Conroy. Let's not forget the Prada-loving co-worker who showed up on his arm at my dad's gala back in July. These guys can be compelling when they want to be. I can testify to that. I fell for the even creepier James Harper before Cassie did.
At the risk of sounding like one of our detective friends, are you sure it's such a good idea to meet with Carla Ferguson? If she's under Conroy's spell, then asking probing questions about her beau's business activities could tick her off. You love in-your-face confrontations with evil masterminds, and you may well get one. I don't see why Carla Ferguson won't set you up with Conroy.
Laura was obviously worried.
Here's the thing. Back in July, I got the same vibe from Carla Ferguson that I got from you, Kim, the first time we met.
Jessica smiled at Kim as she spoke.
No Saraswati tattoo, but Carla was angry that night at my dad's gala when I ran into her in the ladies' room. She was in there removing a spot from the fabulous dress she wore and muttering under her breath when I stepped out of the stall.
Men, she said, sloppy devils, even at a black tie affair.
I urged her to send the guy a bill for ruining that gorgeous dress.
Not when the devil is your boss's boss and a real charmer, she said, sounding angry and sarcastic, you know?
Not words spoken by a woman infatuated with Conroy.
Anyway, she stepped back into accommodating colleague mode fast.
I do deserve a raise. My congratulations to your father. It's a great event. Then she dashed out of there, back to Conroy's side. When I saw her later, she was all smiles, touching the man all flirty-like. Maybe she's conflicted about him. Who knows what it takes to see a guy like that for what he is and get away from him. Maybe she's at that point, or could be, with a nudge.
Well, in my case, Kim said, I found the creep of my life because I was young and dumb and desperate for attention. Anything that seemed like someone gave a damn was hard to resist. He was a troll, out there looking for lost girls and boys like me. What shocks me is that money didn't protect these women from predators like Carr and Conroy. When I first met Mr. P in the dock, I was just grateful to have food and a clean place to sleep.
That wasn't how Kelly fell into their clutches, was it?
Kim asked, looking at Tommy.
No. I'm not sure what put my sister on the doomed girl track. She not only had food and a place to sleep, but friends and family who loved her.
It just wasn't enough, he replied.
Heaviness descended upon them. Jessica hurtled toward despair.
You don't have to understand it to stop it, Bernadette said. Right is right, and wrong is wrong. You stop it when you can, before anyone else gets hurt. I'm going with you to check out this Carla Ferguson person. That red devil won't try any of his funny business with two of us in the room, even if she tells him about your visit.
Let's hope so. I'm in no condition for another Lucy and Ethel situation, Jessica worried aloud.
Peter will be there, too. You won't be going into the lion's den alone this time.
The cat pack will have your back, Tommy said, making hissing sounds and clawing the air.
It would have set Frank on edge if he had been there. Her decision to meet with Carla would have done that, too.
And me, Brian said, shoving one last bite of food in his mouth.
You ready to roll, Peter? Jessica asked, surprised to find she missed Frank. Not the prospect of being chewed out, or the worried look he would have had on his face. There was a kind of comfort she found in his presence.
I guess I like the strong, not-so-silent type, she thought, as she let out a little sigh. Not enough to call him and tell him what she was up to, though.
Sure. Let's go see if Dottie Winchester has the key to nailing this Conroy creep. If that's the case, you won't need a meeting with Carla Ferguson or anyone else after today. I won't rest easy until he's nabbed and can no longer afford the services of a sniper or whatever other hired help he has working for him, Peter said, marching toward the exit. As they headed to the car, Jessica's phone pinged. She stopped to look at it. It's a text message from Detective Hernandez. 31. A Mother Speaks. The Winchester estate sat on a hill in a community Jessica knew well. The city of San Marino, home to the Huntington Library, was a familiar part of family lore. Henry Huntington, her father's namesake, had built a mansion there early in the 20th century. Great-great-uncle Henry, or something like that, played an instrumental role in California history. The Huntington name was everywhere in San Marino, as it was elsewhere in the state. The city, with its tree-lined streets, expansive residences, lavish greenery, parks, and gardens, was picturesque, often featured in Hollywood movies. Dottie Winchester lived in a Georgian Revival masterpiece, sitting at the highest point on one of those lush, shady streets. A member of the household staff welcomed Bernadette and Jessica. Not a butler, but Dottie's 40-ish personal secretary, Andrea Jessup. Jessica had spoken to her that morning to confirm their appointment. Brian and Peter planned to wait in the car. Peter was intent on keeping an eye out for anyone monitoring their whereabouts. As soon as they arrived, Andrea put in a call to their own security team, which showed up in minutes to chat with Peter and Brian. So far, Brian had been on his best behavior, mimicking Peter's demeanor, and not saying a word. Jessica had another of those surges of hope that Brian was not just good-hearted, but teachable. He couldn't be a wannabe surfer and pool boy his entire life. Andrea, in pearls and a twin sweater set, worn with gray woolen slacks, looked every bit the gentlewoman assistant to the matron awaiting them. She had welcomed them all into a gracious, formal entryway, adorned with marble floors and a stunning arrangement of fresh flowers atop a vintage console. Once Peter and Brian connected with the security team, Andrea asked Bernadette and Jessica to follow her down a hallway. Then they passed through an exquisitely detailed living room with classic symmetrical lines, elaborate crown molding, and a massive fireplace. Original art hung on the walls, and an antique tapestry hung above the fireplace. Andrea swept through to a dining room that could seat 20 or more. She opened a set of tall French doors leading outdoors to a patio, affording a view of the pool and gardens beyond. Seated in a wheelchair at a patio table was the matriarch they had come to visit. Jessica almost didn't recognize Dottie Winchester. They had met a few times, but the woman she remembered had been formidable. Taller than her mother, Dorothy Winchester had been a striking figure. The person who stood to greet them was tall, but frail and a little bent. Gone was the dark hair that Jessica recalled. Stylishly cut, Dottie's hair was gray, almost white. Her eyes still shone brightly, but with less confidence and determination than had resided in them the last time they met. "Welcome, Jessica. It's wonderful to see you again. It's been years, hasn't it, since we saw each other?" "Yes, I'm sorry to say that's true. I was in the Palo Alto area for a decade and didn't get back here to L.A. often. I'm afraid I lost track of my family's friends once Mom and Dad were out of the country so much of the time," Jessica said. "Well, there's nothing to be sorry about. You grew up and started a life of your own. That requires focus, doesn't it?" She eyed Jessica's sling, but said nothing. She seemed to tire and sat again. "Let me give you a hand," Bernadette said, with an ease and familiarity that surprised Jessica. She took one of Dottie's arms as Andrea rushed to take the other. The two women eased Dottie back into her seat. "Bernadette, I am so glad to see you. I'm supposed to thank you for your latest contribution to the scholarship fund this year in Guillermo's name at UCLA. Much appreciated. That's old news, though. It's been a while for us, too, hasn't it? Look at what I have with me." She reached into a pocket on the wheelchair and pulled out a beaded rosary. "Bernadette was so kind when Harry passed away," she said, directing her comments to Jessica.
a tower of strength, but I suppose you know that already. How remarkable her life has been, even after the tragic loss of Guillermo.
Yes, I've counted on her kindness and strength my whole life. A lot, lately. Jessica could tell the praise was getting to Bernadette, who was eager to change the subject.
I'm sorry about Sally. I didn't know you lost her, too,
Bernadette said softly.
We kept it all hush-hush, since we weren't certain what had happened. After an inquest ruled her death a terrible accident, I just withdrew. I haven't been well, and haven't wanted to see anyone. I'm sorry.
There's no reason to apologize. Trouble's a hard thing to share. When it involves someone we love so much, it's even harder, Bernadette said.
It was quite a shock, more so than Harry's passing, since she was so young. I was more and more in the dark about her life. We weren't even speaking when she died. I knew she was in trouble, but what could I do? I've thought about the last year before she died, and I still haven't come up with anything else I might have done.
Won't you sit down? Andrea said. She was so quiet that Jessica had almost forgotten she was there.
If you'll excuse me for a minute, I'll go see what's holding up the tea.
Thank you, Andrea. Where are my manners? Andrea has been a blessing through this whole ordeal. If I hadn't been able to rely on her, I don't know what might have happened. She's like you, Bernadette. A rock.
Dottie smiled at Andrea, who returned a brief smile before dashing off.
We're glad you're willing to talk to us, Jessica said.
When Alexis said you had some concerns about Eric Conroy, I didn't hesitate. Sally was always a fragile girl. I blamed myself for that. I was overbearing, but I found her temerity hard to take. Still, she was sweet, smart, and a talented writer and poet. She grew into such a lovely young woman. I believed she had a chance for a happy future, although a writer's life is not an easy one, even with the patronage my friends and I could offer her.
Dottie paused, staring out over the fountains and lavish pool to the pastoral view of well-tended gardens.
When she went out with Eric and they became engaged, I was hopeful at first. I didn't like him much, but I thought her love might bring out the good in him. Within weeks, the pressure started. It was subtle in the beginning. Eric used the time he spent here to figure out which way I was leaning on some issues that had come up at a Pinnacle board meeting. I didn't object to his inquiries, although I would have preferred that he be more direct. I didn't object either to the fact that the man was ambitious and in a hurry to get ahead. The manipulative way he went about it rubbed me the wrong way. Not just manipulation, but distortions of the truth, misrepresenting the positions of others on the board, creating the illusion he had more support than he did for an issue. I knew he was hustling me, Jessica. And I didn't like it. He wanted the top job at Pinnacle, and he wanted to take the company public. I had doubts about both matters.
Sounds issued from behind them, and the French doors opened. A member of the household staff wheeled out a little cart with tea, chocolate-dipped strawberries, diminutive sandwiches, and a lovely assortment of tarts. Andrea made sure the doors were open wide enough for the cart to pass. Once the staff member had served them, Andrea dismissed her.
I'll take it from here.
Thanks. The young server left, and Andrea seated herself with tea and treats of her own.
Now, where was I?
Dottie asked.
Oh, yes. Eric turning up the pressure. When he didn't get his way, hustling me by himself, he enlisted Sally to make his case. That just made me even more convinced that he was an unprincipled man and not leadership material. When I objected to that tactic, my relationship with Sally took a turn for the worse. I didn't understand how bad things could get.
She glanced at Andrea before going on.
Only Andrea, our lawyers, and a few family members know what happened next.
It's okay. We won't tell anyone, Bernadette said.
If I thought it would help stop that despicable monster, I wouldn't mind one bit.
He's slippery as an eel,
Dottie said, taking a sip of her tea. Andrea fidgeted in her chair,
perhaps worried about Dottie, or upset because she knew what was coming.
What happened? Jessica asked.
He broke it off with Sally.